From Jefferson Public Radio at Southern Oregon University, this is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Coming up after the news, TV fiction and reality meet in a sizzling dish called Tremé, the name of the New Orleans neighborhood where it is based. The series will begin airing its fourth and final season late this year on HBO. Regular viewers and non-viewers alike can enjoy something that producers put out while the show is on hiatus, a book of stories and recipes that also bears the name Tremé. Series staff writer and story editor Lolis Eric Eli will join us. We'll talk about the TV series and the way it brings the rich cuisine of New Orleans to the forefront. And we'll talk about Cajun versus Creole cooking, green garlic coleslaw, and Time Satsuma black pepper ice. Really? Lolis Eric Eli, Tremé on TV and in the pot, and your phone calls and emails ahead on the Jefferson Exchange after the news of the hour. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, broadcasting live weekday mornings and rebroadcasting weekday evenings 12 hours later on radio stations serving California and Oregon. And we're found online as well at jeffexchange.org with a listen live link. It is Tuesday, September 10th, 2013. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. In this hour, the stories and the food of New Orleans through the filter of the TV series Tremé. Lolis Eric Eli is the author of the book Tremé, which brings city, TV series, and cuisine together between its covers. You can join our discussion on the Exchange. We'll provide phone numbers and email address shortly. First, a weather forecast for the region from Jefferson Exchange producer Charlotte Duran.
On the northern California coast today, patchy fog and mostly sunny with a high near 65. In Redding and Red Bluff, sunny and hot with a high near 101. In Yreka, sunny and hot with a high near 96. In Weed and Mount Shasta, sunny with a high near 91. On the southern Oregon coast today, sunny and windy with a high near 78. In the Klamath Basin, sunny with a high near 88. In Grants Pass, Medford and Ashland, sunny and hot with a high near 102. On the southern Oregon Cascades and Siskiyou, sunny with a high near 82. In Roseburg and the Umpqua Basin, sunny and hot with a high near 97. And in Eugene and Springfield today, patchy fog and sunny with a high near 91.
It was just yesterday we were talking about how hot and dry it remains, even though we're now into the, well, getting close to the middle of September. But it's going to be this way for a while longer. And, of course, that fire broke out yesterday, the Clover Fire in South Shasta County. CAL FIRE reports 80 structures destroyed, 30 more damaged, and more than 300 threatened. And this is about 7,400 acres, the Clover Fire, on the south end of Shasta County. So it came from nowhere. As of noon yesterday, there was nothing going on. The fire first reported at about 12:40 yesterday. And by last night, it had grown to more than 6,000 acres. So very big, very fast, very scary. And let us hope that this is the end of the fire season and not just the middle of it. As we move through the region, the temperatures will stay about the same. Actually, it'll be slightly hotter in the Rogue Valley than in Redding, if the forecasts for Wednesday hold as we think they will. Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to join our conversations on the Exchange, feel free. Phone numbers are 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Even after battering by storms and politics and corruption and loss of population and more, New Orleans is still a fascinating place. So it was probably a no-brainer to set a TV series there. HBO's Tremé will air a short fourth and final season beginning in December. For the people waiting for the return or considering getting in for the first time, there is a book of stories and recipes out now. And its author joins us on the Exchange today. The book is called Tremé, Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans. Lolis Eric Eli is a New Orleans native, staff writer, and story editor on the Tremé series. He's the author and editor of books on barbecue, with work appearing in several food magazines, and a former columnist for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Lolis, welcome.
Good morning. Welcome.
It's good to have you here. And I, you know, first, condolences. It must have been hard to watch the Times-Picayune cut back on the days it actually publishes, which is about to happen to the Oregonian.
Well, I tell you what's interesting about that. We actually have a newspaper war going on in New Orleans now because the Baton Rouge paper started publishing a New Orleans edition and hiring a lot of those old TP staffers. So in that sense, New Orleans has moved from being behind the curve to sort of ahead of the curve, going back to the newspaper war days.
Well, that's impressive. Good to hear that. Give listeners, Lolas, who may not be familiar with Treme, the TV series, what it's generally about.
Okay. Well, David Simon and Eric Overmyer, big fans of New Orleans R&B from the 50s and 60s, initially they wanted to do a show about that, which was not apt to sell, but then with Hurricane Katrina, there's a renewed focus on New Orleans, and so they conceived of a show that would be about New Orleanians rebuilding their lives in the post-Katrina environment, particularly New Orleanians, to exemplify the culture of the city. So we have a chef, several musicians, a Mardi Gras Indian chief who's also a carpenter, those kinds of people who sort of tell the story about how culture helped rebuild the city.
And why set specifically in the neighborhood known as Treme, and what's the relation of Treme to the rest of New Orleans that people might know, like the French Quarter or the Lower Ninth or any of that?
Treme is literally across the street from the French Quarter. Faubourg Treme is its full name, and Faubourg means false city or suburb in French. And as New Orleans grew beyond the French Quarter, which is a very small area, Faubourg Treme is one of the first places that people went. That movement also coincided with the Haitian Revolution and a lot of people from Haiti moving to the city. And thus, Faubourg Treme ended up being particularly rich in terms of New Orleans culture. Even though we named this show after this neighborhood, it really is about the city more broadly. But Treme is very much the epicenter of New Orleans culture, and so much of what we think of about the music and the architecture, those things are emblematic in Treme. And so in some ways, Treme is the best place to set it.
Is Treme more the center than the French Quarter in the sense that the French Quarter is really where the tourists go and Treme is where the locals go?
No, I wouldn't say that. The French Quarter is still the heart of the city in a whole lot of ways. But what you have in Treme is a residential area that maintains much of its architectural integrity, that you don't have to worry about seeing tourists underfoot all the time.
Right. For the folks who aren't familiar with the show, or for that matter, what some of the titles are in TV, you are a story editor in addition to a staff writer. What's the story editor do?
You know, in television, it's very important that you give people titles, often in lieu of giving them more money.
So, that's why there's all those producers.
Exactly. So the story editor title really varies from show to show. Most recently, I'm working on a show called Hell on Wheels on AMC. It comes on Saturday night, and I'm story editor on Hell on Wheels as well. And it means two totally different things. On Hell on Wheels, it means I'm a slightly elevated writer. On Treme, it meant that I did a whole lot of ancillary writing, like for the website and for award show application copy, that kind of thing. So it was sort of like I did much of the writing other than the actual scripts, in addition to working on the scripts.
Oh, yeah, and then they get to hand you the book and say, this is ancillary, too. This is kind of like the website, just larger.
Exactly. But, you know, I had been doing food writing for a while, so the book was really exciting to me, so I can't complain about that.
That is an interesting mix of things to do. I mean, food is fairly central to the series, Treme, isn't it?
Well, what we did was we had a chef as the main character. And, you know, David Simon's whole conception is to try to get as close to reality as possible. And whereas other shows have had restaurant settings but not really taken advantage of it, in New Orleans, the food is so central that can and should be a character. And we got Tony Bourdain to be a consultant on the show, and a big part of what he brought to it with a realistic view of life in the kitchen. So we're not just talking about someone who we talk about as being a chef, but who you don't actually see doing it. She's doing it, dealing with a variety of issues that are reflective both of post-Katrina New Orleans and of chef life more broadly.
Now, Tony Bourdain also has one of the forewords in the book. Anthony Bourdain describes New Orleans as a hell broth of colors, flavors, and influences. I think he'd probably agree with the second part, but a hell broth? Is that a fair statement?
You know, I think a lot of times Tony is nostalgic for his hellish days when he was out drinking and carousing. He's not quite like that anymore, but New Orleans still is open to that possibility. I mean, the bars don't close.
Really?
If you decide to have a drink at 6 a.m., you could find several places open.
Huh. Okay, I guess I didn't stay up late enough on my trips to New Orleans.
Probably wise.
Now, the TV series, you do have occasionally real-life chefs playing themselves, is that right?
Yeah. One of the things that we do often is mix real-life folks with actors, and in that way get another sense of reality. So we had Eric Repair, our chef, went to New York in the second season and cooked with Eric Repair and cooked with David Chang. additionally, several major New York chefs came to visit her in New Orleans. So Tom Colicchio was also there, and Alfred Pertale. So we've had chefs actually play themselves. Wiley Dufresne was on the show as well. And in terms of how to give our character the kind of credibility, the fact that the musicians are on stage with real musicians and our chefs are in the kitchen with real chefs, that gives you some sense of how we're trying to meld reality and fiction.
Much more to talk about. The book is Treme, Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans. Lola's Eric Eli, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, is the author. You can join us when we come back from the break in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Lola's Eric Eli. He is a New Orleans native, a staff writer and story editor on the HBO TV series Treme, and the author of the book called Treme, Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans. It's part about the series, part about the city, and a lot about cooking. All kinds of good recipes in here. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So a series that blends the kinds of things that Treme does. You got New Orleans as a character in itself. You got food, you got music, all kinds of things in here. It seems like this show would take some writers with unique talents. I mean, so obviously they'd be looking for people like you, who's a New Orleans native, knows food, knows the city, etc. Was it a fairly difficult team to assemble?
Well, David Simon had a lot of success with The Wire. One of his writing buddies from back in the day was Eric Overmyer, who was his co-creator here. And for the most part, they gathered folks they'd worked with before, like the novelist George Pelicanos and the late TV writer David Mills, plus some folks with some New Orleans expertise. So Tom Piazza, a dear friend of mine and a novelist who's been in New Orleans for the last 20 years, they brought him along as well, and like me, he had not had television experience before. And then Mari Kornhauser, who's primarily a feature film writer, has came along in the second season as a script writer as well. So really, it was a good mix of folks, and there's a lot of mutual respect and a lot of commonality in terms of our feeling about the city. So I think it worked well.
Well, and David Simon, you mentioned the creator here. He's the executive producer, continued in that role in Treme, the series. He describes the overdue and repent cycle of people who visit New Orleans. Describes his own weight ballooning up, and then he left New Orleans for a while and got it back under control, and then came back and began to get even higher than he did before. Is this a somewhat easier cycle for people like yourself who are from the New Orleans area?
Well, you know, man, you got to pace yourself. But that's also the part and parcel of New Orleans culture. If you think about the whole idea of carnival, the sense that you're going to do whatever you want to do, eat all the meat you want to eat, indulge in all these things on Fat Tuesday, then on Ash Wednesday you repent. And Ellis Marcellus notes that New Orleans is a Catholic city, even though at this point Catholics are no longer in the majority. The sense of that repentance cycle that David Simon describes is very much part of how we live. So the idea that New Orleanians are just constantly always out there drinking and carousing in the streets, that's not true. When you come there on a Tuesday night and you see people doing that, 90% of them are tourists. But New Orleanians do have a sense of pacing, and we do have a need to have some fun like that.
Absolutely. Okay, so yeah, well, it's like with anything. It's kind of like living in Greater New York and you don't go to the Statue of Liberty very much. You're not going to go to the French Quarter and get loaded very much if you live in New Orleans.
Right.
Got it. The mix in the book, Treme, of real and fiction, you got, for example, Jeanette Desautels and the other names in here. Obviously, these aren't her recipes. Whose recipes are they in the book?
It's really a mix. We try to organize the book by character. So in that sense, each individual character takes you on their own food tour of the city. And their tours range from stuff that they cook themselves to stuff that they got their mothers or fathers to cook, to recipes from their favorite restaurants. Most of the recipes you see on the show, most of the dishes you see on the show are in the book. And Soa Davies, who used to work with Eric Repair at Le Bernardin, she created many of those recipes. But also I got chef friends of mine like Jackie Blanchard from Restaurant August, and another friend of mine helped out Sue Chiravolo. So those recipes, some of them are created, some of them are mine, some of them are my mother's, some of them are from restaurants, and some of them are just straight up from the show.
How many generations back do the recipes in your family go?
Three. There's a recipe for a carrot casserole that my father's aunt used to make, and that my mother learned, and as far as I know, she's the only one who still makes it.
Huh. It's an inspirational book, I'll tell you, particularly with the use of vegetables. I went home last night and didn't take a recipe out of the book, but tried something that the kids kind of looked at funny, but they ate it.
Well, you know, really trying to have a range of recipes that reflect the way in which people cook now. Part of what happens in cookbooks these days, you have sort of food pornography where you get books from, you know, your favorite restaurant, and you look at these recipes and you know you never cook them. It's like, well, first you go and kill the buffalo and then you hang it to dry for 2 weeks. Well, nobody's actually going to do that. We got stuff in here like microwave pralines, and I had a big debate with myself about whether to include that kind of convenience food. But if the purpose of this book is to be reflective of the show and reflective of how New Orleanians live and cook and eat now, that it's not so much a question of what my taste is or what my preference is for doing things the old-fashioned way. It's more to be an appropriate reflection on what's happening in New Orleans food now. So we've got a couple of recipes that will take you a day or two to do. We also got a couple of recipes that will take you just a few minutes to do.
All right, so bring on the microwave.
Exactly.
Let the microwave live. Let's go to the back of the book first, because there's a basic Creole seasoning back there. How many dishes are going to use this kind of seasoning?
Well, the truth is, it's in essence seasoned salt.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything, whatever your favorite seasoned salt is, New Orleans is usually Tony Sachere, Chef Paul Prudhomme has a line of seasonings, Emma has a line of seasonings. But in a sense, this is their version of Lowry's or all salt, what's the name of that, the other season all.
Mm-hmm.
And so we use it consistently, but what happens is that we try to have a uniformity in the book, because if you're going to make two different dishes, one chef calls for Paul Prudhomme seasoning, another calls for Tony Sachere seasoning. Our attitude is that you can certainly go and buy those, and we mention them in the book. We also have a basic seasoning that we think will work for most of those recipes.
All right, and that's the basic Creole seasoning.
Exactly.
I had read once of the reasons for spicy food in southern Louisiana, and it was an interesting one. What's your knowledge of that story?
Well, I think it has to do with the mix of people who came to the city. I mean, people always talk about New Orleans food as if it's all French. And much of my work has been trying to debunk that myth, because our food is at least as much a product of our West African ancestors and our Haitian ancestors and our Latin American ancestors as it is of folks from France. What happened is that New Orleans, being a port city and being a Francophone city that then was controlled by the Spanish for much of its history, meant that a lot of what was going on there was a dialogue with things happening south of us, in Port-au-Prince, in Cuba, in Mexico, and so forth. And so our food is spicy in many ways, in many of the same ways and for the same reason that those places have spicy food. The other thing is that you got to be careful in talking about spicy food in the context of New Orleans. I used to think that our food was spicy until I tasted Indian food and Ethiopian food and Thai food. Our food is spicy compared to sort of middle America norm, but the truth is, and on the spectrum of world cuisine, it's not so much spicy, it's well-seasoned. Lots of onion and garlic and that kind of thing in there, in addition to some salt and pepper.
But you're right, there are other cuisines that'll blow your tongue right out of your mouth, and this doesn't quite get to that point.
Not at all.
We're talking to Lolas Eric Eli. He's the author of Tremé, Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans. It is a connection with the HBO TV series Tremé, for which Lolas is a staff writer and story editor. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about New Orleans cuisine. Haven't even gotten to the dishes yet, aside from the basic Creole seasoning. Our phone number is on the exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, our local number is 541-552-6782, and our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. One of our listeners wants to know if Tremé means anything in French, or if it's just a name.
Treme is a proper name for a man named Claude Treme who owned a plantation, and his plantation made up much of what is now the neighborhood.
Oh, okay. It was that's interesting to know, because we stayed once at a B&B on Esplanade, New Orleans, between Claude and Treme. I didn't realize it was both of his names.
Yep, exactly. In fact, you must have been right near my house.
Oh, really? Right there?
Yep. You know, I did a documentary about Faubourg Treme, and focusing on the civil rights movement there of the 1800s. And that was a big part of my education about it. It's a fascinating neighborhood.
It really is. There's a lot of history that goes on there. And you get into that in the book, too, about the things that had happened there in the past. Let's talk about the supplies for cooking unique to the region, because some of the things like Creole tomatoes and Merlotons, these are... What are those?
Okay. Well, Creole tomatoes really means tomatoes cooked in the greater New Orleans area. I mean, grown in the greater New Orleans area. We contend that they taste better and they look better, but the truth is any quality tomatoes that you get can work for most of those dishes. For example, Roma tomatoes were imported from Sicily when the truck farmers, most of whom were Sicilians, began to realize there's a market for that sort of thing. So you find Roma tomatoes a lot, both fresh and in cans around New Orleans. In terms of Merlotton, that's a term that only is used in New Orleans and in Haiti. It really is the same as a chayote squash, or in Jamaica they call it chocho or Christophine. So if you live around folks from Latin America, you can usually find a chayote squash in the grocery store. And we would argue that there's some differences in terms of the variety. And after the storm, when so many of people's Merlotton vines were destroyed, they would go to the supermarket and buy Merlotton and then use the seeds to try to grow another bush that wouldn't quite work out. So there are some subtle differences, but for the purposes of trying to make this food in Northern California, it's the same vegetable.
So let me get to that issue, though, because you mentioned the storm. And so since Katrina, since Rita, since the oil spill, I mean, there seems to be quite a few things that have interrupted what were the normal food supplies for New Orleans. Has the cuisine had to change in response?
I don't think the cuisine has changed because of those things, because in that regard, we've pretty much recovered. Even the fishing industry has been hard hit, but you can still get more and better fresh fish in New Orleans than you can in most of the country. A big part of what is changing the cuisine is the shifting immigration patterns. For decades now, we've had a large Vietnamese population, so much so that you go into restaurants that are not Vietnamese, but you'll see fish sauce or other Vietnamese influences on the menu. And we're having a whole influx of folks from Latin America now, particularly Honduras and Guatemala. And at this point, much of their influence is in food trucks, but I suspect 10, 15 years from now, you'll see more of those restaurants, and you'll see more New Orleans chefs coming out of those cultures. It's a guy named Adolfo Garcia, who's Honduran, New Orleanian, is born and raised in New Orleans, and he has a couple of restaurants that exemplify some of that food.
So it sounds like if you had been to New Orleans, say, pre-storm, certainly, say 6-7 years ago, the storm was actually 8 years ago, wasn't it?
2005, yes.
Okay, so 8 years. All right, before that, though, let's say 10 years ago. So you get a very different snapshot if you hit the restaurants at New Orleans in 10 years ago and if you hit the same restaurant or the hit restaurants of quality today, because the cuisine changes with the influences of the people who come into it.
Well, most of the classic New Orleans restaurants were in older parts of the city and on high ground. What people often miss about what happened in New Orleans is that the earliest settlements in the city were on the highest ground because Mississippi floods from time to time. So even those restaurants should have gone to 10 years ago. If you talk about places like Commander's Palace and Brennan's and Antoine's and Galatoire's, those places are still open now. And so in that sense, it would be possible for us to spend a week in New Orleans and only go to restaurants that are 10 or 20 years old. Mm-hmm. Or we could go to all these new places that have opened most recently. But the classic is still very much in evidence in New Orleans.
All right, let us take another call from Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lola's Eric Eli. His book is Treme.
Hey, was I ever delighted to hear that this was the theme of the program today. I'm not a New Orleans native, but I lived there for 10 years from the late 70s through the late 80s. And it was like living in a foreign country when I first came there. It was like, what? Am I still in the United States? And I say that in all the best ways. It was pretty amazing. And the food is spectacular. And I think I'm going to get this book and because it's really hard to find anything remotely resembling authentic New Orleans food outside of New Orleans. Believe me, I've tried it all over the country, and very few restaurants actually get it. I did find a place way up in the San Juan Islands once called the Whale and Gator, where the chef was a New Orleans girl, and well, sadly that closed.
Hence the Gator
reference. Anyway, that for me is the most amazing show I think I've ever seen on TV. I think it even tops The Wire in some ways, and I love The Wire. But just pass on my thanks to you and all the crew who do such an amazing job. It's more real than any reality show I've ever seen. Whenever I watch it, I feel like I'm back in New Orleans.
All right. Thanks for the call, Sandy.
Sure.
Thanks, indeed.
Any thoughts on that, Lolas?
Well, I think a big part of why New Orleans is different from the rest of the country is that for so long you had people who spoke French who were angry that Napoleon sold French to the Americas. And there was a sense that we were different and proud of it. So other parts of the country were sort of rushing to prove that they could and should be Americans. And we were like, well, what's the big deal about being American? Our food is better, our coffee is better, and, you know, certainly our seafood is better. So in that sense, there was an extent to which we have maintained that. And I don't want to mischaracterize the city in that there are a whole lot of people in New Orleans who wish we had more Walmarts and more chain stores and more chain restaurants. It's not as if everyone there is of one accord in that regard. But the truth is there's a core culture in New Orleans. And no matter how much the politicians try to destroy it, it still remains.
In order to cook New Orleans style, as we get into the recipes in the book, do you have to let go of some rigid concepts? Do you have to re-equip your kitchen? I mean, what sort of mindset is required before you begin to cook dishes out of this book?
Well, you know, mind you, there's a range of dishes in the book. So some of these dishes really are modern restaurant dishes that, in that sense, are influenced by the things happening in San Francisco and in New York and in Portland. So in that way, it's much like cooking those recipes. But if we're talking about traditional Creole cuisine, a few things come to mind. One is you got to brown stuff. The idea of just putting things in a pot of boiling water, you don't do that. You brown the meat before you put it in, or in the case of vegetables, most of the time they're seasoned with meat, so you'll brown the bacon or the sausage before you put that in. Also, étouffée, or smothering, that technique of cooking, means you have a whole lot of onions that you cook until the onions become part of the sauce. And so if you taste it, it wouldn't be obvious to you that you're eating onions, but you'd have a very thick sauce. Those are two of the main things that go into it. And the other thing is to not be afraid of salt and pepper. And I'm not even talking about spicy per se, but so often, you know, one chef said, salt is the cheapest thing in the kitchen. So if you're going to use something, use it. And there's an art to figuring out how to salt something so that it's not overly salty, but that the flavors really come out. So those are the things that I would say initially are crucial. Most of the time we season our vegetables with some sort of smoked or pickled meat. Obviously people are trying to get somewhat away from meat, and I got a recipe in there for vegetarian mustard greens that I think has much of the flavor of meat cooked greens now. In fact, that's my preferred approach without the meat now.
I was going to ask you about that term, étouffée, and that just means smothering?
Exactly.
Okay. Now, Creole versus Cajun, you do get into this in the book. What are the differences in the cuisine?
Well, the main thing to keep in mind is we're talking about two regions of the state that are relatively close to each other, about 150 miles apart. And particularly now, given how easy it is to drive places, the idea that you can maintain a separateness while being so close is sort of ridiculous. Additionally, you have the main dishes in each cuisine are the same. Red beans and rice, gumbo, étouffée. These are going to be common whether you're in Cajun country around Lafayette or in Creole country around New Orleans. But in terms of differences, the Cajuns tend to season their food with either tasso sausage tasso ham, or andouille sausage. New Orleans uses pickled meat and smoked sausage. And Cajun food does tend to be a bit spicier than Creole food.
All right, much more to talk about. We have a few more stories and recipes to get into with Lolas Eric Eli. His book is Tremé, Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans. It's a connection to the TV series Tremé on HBO. You can join us on The Exchange when we return from this break. Back with Lolas and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today with Lolis Eric Eli. He is a staff writer and story editor on the TV series Treme, longtime food writer, columnist for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Lots of knowledge of Southern cuisine in New Orleans area in particular, and so that's one of the reasons he's working on the series. He's the author of a book called Treme, Stories and Recipes from the Heart of New Orleans. You can join us as we talk about New Orleans cuisine or the TV show or both, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Lolis, when I was asking about mindset and equipment in the kitchen, for example, the recipe Listen to Your Fish, what is a non-reactive saucepan?
Well, if you use either a cast iron pan or even Teflon-coated pan, the main thing is that some of the old pans would sometimes react with some of the acid that you'd put in food. So if you got any doubt about that, just go to the cooking store and ask them what will be the best one to use. But these days, most of the cooking pans are indeed non-reactive, so it's not as big an issue as it used to be.
Okay, so just to kind of carry over from previous meals or something?
Well, also, sometimes if you put certain ingredients, certain acids in the pan itself, it could react.
Oh.
And so that's... it's interesting because those recipes are written for the most part by the chefs who create them. And in some instances, me and the editors tried to make the recipes uniform. In other instances, we tried to make it reflective of whatever the chef wrote when they sent the recipe to us. So you don't see that term in a whole lot of other recipes, in part because it's not so much an issue now.
Okay, understood. The the variety of stuff in the book is just amazing. I mean, the just mind-blowing recipes like green garlic coleslaw.
Well, we wanted to have some vegetarian recipes in the book. It was interesting that one of the stylists on the show does a lot of catering. She's not vegan or vegetarian, but she does a lot of catering that caters to vegan people. And so the idea of doing that we thought would be a great way of giving variety to the book and also remind you about the range of food that's in New Orleans these days.
When you were talking just a moment ago about the Cajun versus Creole and flavoring stuff with ham or sausage, I mean, if you're going to be cooking vegetarian or vegan New Orleans style, what do you use as flavors to substitute for the lack of ham or sausage?
We talk about the Holy Trinity in New Orleans. That has nothing to do with traditional religion.
Right.
It has everything to do with onion, celery, and bell pepper. So I would say use a lot of those things, other herbs as well. We use a lot of thyme in New Orleans cooking as well. So, and butter is always crucial. So if you are not vegan, butter is perfect.
Okay. Well, you mentioned thyme, and I wanted to ask about the thyme satsuma black pepper ice. This, just the name makes it mysterious. Is it dessert, appetizer, cocktail, what?
Oh, it could be any of those, a palate cleanse. I mean, what ends up happening is that sort of an easy way to do a kind of ice cream-like thing is to just freeze a concoction of juices. The idea of using thyme and black pepper in the ice is consistent with this sort of modern trend of combining savory and sweet together. So it's an ice much like you'd have a saved Italian ice on the streets of San Francisco or other places. So it's our take on that.
Fun. I have to try that one, thyme satsuma black pepper ice. More regional specialties, things that are unique to New Orleans. What are callas?
Ah, kala, actually.
Kala, okay.
Kala are fried rice fritters, and they used to be very common in New Orleans, and women would sell them on the streets of the city, going back even during slavery at a point when women would do this in part to raise money to buy their own freedom. But because they were street food, it never really made it to restaurants in a big way. They were kind of dying out, and a friend of mine, Poppy Tooker, helped resurrect kala. And so, in part because their importance to the history of the cuisine, in part because I don't want them to die, we actually have two recipes. One is a savory kala made with rice and baking powder. And you can decide to have those and be serving them within an hour or so because they don't require the fermentation of the yeast kala. And those are the sweet ones. And you mix the rice with some flour and some eggs and some sugar leave it overnight with the yeast, and the next morning you have something that tastes as if it was flavored with rum or with bourbon, and that's because, of course, the yeast has been fermenting.
Oh, but you're not adding any booze. It's just the fermentation itself that gives that flavor.
Exactly, exactly.
Oh, that's fascinating. Got to try that one, too. I have a lot of dog-eared pages in this book.
Just put a bunch of stuff in a bowl, leave it overnight, and fry it the next morning.
I like that approach. You mentioned Commander's Palace, one of the longstanding New Orleans restaurants, and there's a recipe in there for Creole roasted turkey. What goes into that in addition to the turkey?
one of the things we do in New Orleans often is we define things as being Creole, really to say that it's ours. Well, why you call it Creole roasted turkey as opposed to Commander's Palace roasted turkey? That's in many ways the decision made by the chef. So I can't tell you that it's totally different from other roast turkey recipes. And in fact, I'm trying to remember all the details of that recipe because I did not know it by heart.
Understood. Okay.
It's just the Commander's Palace approach.
All right, let me switch to this topic then, because when we talk about roasting turkeys, it reminds me that there is that trend that seemed to start in the southern United States with people using the big vat of boiling peanut oil and lowering their Thanksgiving turkey into the... And, of course, a few of them have set their houses on fire, too, but... Which raises then the question about regional cuisine generally. And we talked about Cajun versus Creole, but it seems like the influence of that cuisine stops probably not too far over the Mississippi state line.
Well, what you'll find often, though, is if you go to a restaurant, you'll see, say, Creole bread pudding on the menu, a New Orleans-style this or that on the menu. And so in that sense, even though a lot of those dishes don't necessarily travel, many of them do. The deal with the deep-fried turkey is that requires a whole lot of equipment and a whole lot of oil and skill. The food writer for the Times Picayune, the former food writer for the Times Picayune, Dale Curry, talks about how when she was first wrote about fried turkeys, she forgot to say that it needed to be done outside.
Oh, no.
And there were a couple of garages that were set on fire. Not a pretty sight.
No, not at all. Okay, you'd mentioned bread pudding just now. There is a lot of fair number of bread pudding recipes in here. Why bread pudding so big in New Orleans?
Well, I think a lot of it is because New Orleans French bread only lasts about a day fresh, which means you always have a lot of bread that you need to do stuff with. Although bread pudding initially was an English invention, by the time the French got to New Orleans, it was a big part of the French lexicon as well. So that was it's one of those things that became very popular. My guess is you'll find bread pudding more commonly on New Orleans restaurant menus than you will and menus anywhere else in the world.
So does that French bread just get really, really hard after a day?
Exactly. But when you soften it, either by making what we call pain perdu or lost bread, which is basically sweetened French toast, or if you make it into a bread pudding, it ends up working wonderfully because the bread is very airy, and so those pockets can soak up the custard and make a great bread pudding.
Sounds good.
I want to return to your question about the Commander's Palace turkey recipe, because now I'm remembering exactly what makes it so Creole.
Okay.
That turkey is brined in crab boil. And crab boil is basically the ingredients that we choose to boil our seafood in. So there's nothing in the boil itself that's a meat product. It's just a range of various peppers and spices. And so when you brine the turkey in that, it means that you're getting a flavor throughout the bird. And so that's why they call that Creole turkey.
Okay, but when you say crab boil, it's just the spices, not actually crab stuff in there?
Exactly, exactly. Okay. And you can either get it in a liquid form or you can get it in a packet of dry ingredients.
And so how is the brining done? Do you soak it in there? Do you inject it in there? What is it?
Well, you soak it, but the truth is you can do it either way. What people have been doing more and more now is brining birds for a few hours or overnight in order to see to it that when you get into the middle of the bird, it's not bland.
Ah, get it. Okay. I want to ask about because you mentioned the kalaz that some people were selling to buy their way out of slavery. There's a long history, obviously, of slavery and poverty and other things in New Orleans. Also a long history of food sold on the street, like the kalaz. And you have a special section here about Mr. Okra, Arthur Robinson. Tell us about him.
Well, Mr. Okra drives through neighborhoods in New Orleans in a sort of beat-up pickup truck selling vegetables. And the advantage is that if either you don't have a car or if you just rather buy it from Mr. Okra for the convenience, you can just go and buy stuff from him. Now, as a lot of the truck farmers made enough money to actually open grocery stores, particularly Italians or Sicilians who moved to New Orleans, a lot of that truck tradition sort of died down. There are still a few corners in New Orleans where there are truck farmers. And you know, if you go down Napoleon Avenue or you go down a part of Carrollton Avenue, you'll find people selling these foods out of their trucks. But Mr. Okra became kind of a cause célèbre because his truck broke down. And people have gotten so used to hearing his call every morning, "I got okra, I got oranges," that was sort of missing. So there's a fundraiser to buy him a new truck. So Mr. Okra is back in business and doing well.
When was that fundraiser?
It was about 4 years ago.
Really? Okay. So, wow, that's...
In fact, you can go on YouTube and find stuff on Mr. Okra.
I did see some out there, yeah. Mr. Okra, Arthur Robinson. But food sellers on the street, he's really like the last of a breed, it sounds like.
Yeah. Now, mind you, the food truck thing sort of brings back some of that. You also have people who are not on the street per se, but who spend all morning cooking and then go around to office buildings and beauty salons and sell food in that way. But I think it's an example of where health departments and regulations have kind of killed an aspect of our culture.
Right, and in some cases for good reason.
Yeah, I mean, you got to be careful. But, you know, what ends up happening, though, is that if you're in this business, then you can't afford to serve something that's too bad or that is unsafe because your reputation will spread like wildfire. Now, the problem, of course, is if I do this once a year and therefore you have no idea what my reputation is. But for people who are doing this day in and day out, it becomes very quickly known who's doing a good job and who's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that word would spread fast, pretty much like the dysentery would as well.
Exactly.
Some of the cuisine seems like there's certainly the element of poverty driving some of this, like braised turkey necks. I mean, this is not really a part of the turkey you'd voluntarily eat, but you know, if you can't afford much more than that, that's what you'd eat, right?
Yeah, well, turkey necks are very important now, street food in New Orleans. You can find people selling turkey necks at parades and so forth. That's certainly an aspect of the cuisine, this idea of how do you take ingredients that were not, you know, Jessica Harris has a book called High on the Hog.
Mm-hmm.
And High on the Hog was a term, particularly in the South, that meant you were doing well, because if you think about the most expensive parts of the hog, the ham and the chops and so forth, those are high up. But the shanks and the feet and the snout, those are low on the hog, and that's what poor people ate. But trying to make something quality out of that is a big part of the ethos of Southern cuisine, and New Orleans cuisine shares that ethos as well.
Ah, I never knew that that's where High on the Hog came from.
Mm-hmm.
It's another great bit of education here today. I was surprised to read that you differentiate between a po' boy sandwich and a poor boy.
Well, really, it's a question of preference in terms of which term you prefer. What's his name? Tom Fitzmaurice, who's a very important New Orleans food writer and restaurant critic, likes the term poor boy. He says it goes back to the original term when the Martin brothers and their sandwich shop, in sympathy with the striking streetcar workers in the 1920s, offered them free sandwiches in support and solidarity with them. They talked about this is for those poor boys who have been on strike for so many months, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of that history has kind of been lost. So po' boy, you don't even think about it in terms of its constituent word. You just think about it as the name of a sandwich.
All right. There's so much more to talk about and no time in which to do it. So I want to thank Lola's Eric Eli for joining us today. You have a great job. You get to live in New Orleans. You get to talk about New Orleans. You get to cook in New Orleans, eat in New Orleans. Congratulations and good luck.
Jeffrey, thanks a lot, man. It's been a great interview.
Pleasure's mine. I want to give you a couple of notes here on programming here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Of course, President Obama will speak this evening about his idea for going into Syria because of the use of chemical weapons there. That, of course, somewhat up in the air now that Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, is attempting to broker a deal whereby Syria will give up control of its chemical weapons to international authorities. The president's speech will go on as planned at 6 o'clock tonight, our time. That'll be covered aired live here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. So President Obama speaking about Syria tonight at 6 here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Also, I can let you know about the public reception coming for JPR to the Eureka Theater in Eureka on September 20th at 7. This is a chance for people to get to ask questions of JPR staff and board members as well, because this is in conjunction with the board meeting. So again, a public reception for anybody who wants to come, September 20th at 7 at the Eureka Theater in Eureka. If you have questions, call us at 541-552-6301. And that will do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. Tomorrow on the Exchange, we'll talk about the secession vote in Siskiyou County. In our Vents Day segment, we'll talk about tobacco enforcement to keep teens from buying cigarettes, and we'll talk about nullification votes on laws in various states. 9 o'clock, we'll talk about wastewater treatment naturally, as it's done in Eugene and Arcata. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren, also manning the controls today as our engineer. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.